is United States against Woods. Mr. Rapp.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Rath. I'm the court-appointed attorney for Donald Woods. This court has heard over the course of many cases defendants raising alibis, but it rarely has seen a situation where the alibi is recorded on videotape and the videotape is introduced by the government as one of its own exhibits. We have a situation here where the defendant, Donald Woods, is charged with participating in a bank robbery. Woods says he wasn't there. A co-defendant says he was there. Either he was or wasn't. That leads to the two significant errors I believe the district court made. The first error concerns allowing evidence of a prior relationship between Donald Woods and a woman named Amy Sefik. The relationship that Judge St. Eve allowed into evidence over a motion in limine seeking to bar it was that Woods and Sefik had a relationship of Woods being a drug seller and Sefik being a drug buyer of crack. So from the moment that Sefik takes the witness stand, she was one of the early witnesses in this trial, the jury already gets it in its mind that Woods is a bad person, that Woods is a drug dealer. And so when you start with the fact that Woods is a drug dealer, what he then submits as an alibi has less and less credibility. I suggested there are many ways that the government could have brought to the jury's attention a reason why Sefik and Woods had a relationship.
But all of those reasons would have been false, wouldn't they?
No. Absolutely
would not. The reason was that they had a prior deal as drug supplier and drug buyer.
That's why
she gave him the car often.
There's no doubt about that, Your Honor. But at the same time, there is evidence at trial that Sefik and Woods live within a five-minute walk of each other. They both had kids. The kids would play at each other's house. Sefik would come to Woods' house, or at least the house that he was living in. Woods would go to Sefik's house. Yes, that would not be, yes, probably the real reason, the reason that started their relationship was the drug selling, the drug buying. But the question is prejudice to the defendant. If the government says the jury needs to know why this woman out of the blue would have lent Donald Woods her car the morning of the bank robbery, there is a perfectly reasonable explanation that doesn't go on and say to the jurors, the guy's a drug dealer. They could have provided an explanation. It would not have been false. Did it start for another reason? Yes, but the question is prejudice. The second error that I believe the district judge made in terms of allowing evidence in is William Tierney was a bank manager. Tierney testifies that the day before the robbery, he sees a black man sitting in the bank lobby on a cell phone. And basically he says, would you please turn off the cell phone? It's against credit union policy to have cell phones on. Tierney testifies at trial that Woods is there. The only reason that Tierney's testimony, or what Tierney's testimony does in coming in, is it says to the jury that Donald Woods was casing the bank. Again, prejudicial. Now, why do we believe that Tierney's testimony wasn't credible? Because within a day or so after Tierney, the bank robbery takes place, Tierney draws a sketch of an individual who does not resemble Donald Woods. Donald Woods has no sideburns. He's as bald as it's possible to be. Tierney, who says he's actually not just someone who's drawing a picture, but someone who has some artistic talent, says absolutely on trial, on cross-examination, that, in fact, the person I sketched had the sideburns, and I know it was the guy. So what ends up happening is now we have Tierney's testimony coming in and effectively saying to the jury that we have Donald Woods, a person that may or may not have been the individual in the bank that day or the day before the bank robbery, casing the bank. These are two errors that I believe the district court made. And why are these errors important? Because it becomes a close question in the jury's mind. Was Woods there or wasn't he? As the court has seen from the briefs, the alibi is very extensive. It describes a situation where Woods and his girlfriend are seen on videotape close in time to the time of the bank robbery at the Joliet Police Department, that they are seen a second time.
Close in time is the critical factor here.
There's no doubt. Close in time
is the time.
It's not the time, and of course that hurt Woods. That if it had been,
and so did the co-defendant testifying against him.
Well, and that brings me to the next issue in terms of the credibility. Of course, juries can accept the credibility of people, but when we have a close case here where we have something where this isn't just Donald Woods sitting back there and no defense whatsoever that the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. We have Woods making an aggressive alibi defense that is not, it's not incredible defense. So in terms of is Christian Noel credible? Well, as I pointed out again on cross-examination at trial, Noel lies his head off. He lies about his role in the bank robbery. He lies about what Woods' role in the bank robbery is. He is a person who is just making stuff up. And in terms of his credibility, yes, the jury could accept it. Apparently they did. But even Noel's testimony was undercut by the fact that while he's sitting up in Wisconsin, in a county jail, he meets another individual. Both of these are federal defendants who are housed in Wisconsin. He tells another federal defendant, I committed this bank robbery with my cousins. And this individual, Quentin Reed, comes into trial. He doesn't have to testify. He's already under indictment on a totally separate case. There's no real upside for him to testify. He didn't get anything from the government. Certainly didn't get anything from me. Quentin Reed comes in and testifies that while sitting in the in a Wisconsin county jail, this Christian Noel
would just stand still at the podium.
I apologize, Judge. I apologize.
This is not a jury speech.
Is it?
Well, in a way it is.
Yeah, it is. Isn't cousin kind of a generic term in certain circles? My cousin, my cousins.
The government certainly pointed that out in its brief. And yes,
and the witness was questioned about that too. Wasn't
yes, he was. He was questioned, and it could indeed just be this is the vernacular that is described. But Reed was questioned, and again, to me, the issue is not, is there some one issue here that should require this court to reverse? It is the cumulative nature of the problems here. But let me, and again, I'd like to, going back to the original point I made about Sefik, this woman admits under cross-examination that she used crack, she used it, I think she said sometimes 20 times a day. This woman is, again, someone who on its face would not be credible. Can the jury believe her? Of course they could. Did they believe her? Apparently. But it's the fact that you bring all of this together. Let me just briefly turn to three sentences.
Of course, the plate with her identifiable name on it was spotted by third parties, right?
Absolutely. But the question is, was Woods in the car? I mean, that's the issue. Yes, her car with the SEFCIF, and then it was an issue as to the final letter, whether it was an F or an E, clearly. Let me turn to three sentencing issues, and then I'm done. The first one is the BB gun. It's the brandishing of a weapon. The district court had a three-level increase. Again, the question is, should a three-level increase be given to a dangerous weapon? This court has said that a BB gun, in fact, can be a dangerous weapon, and I'm not arguing that. But these BB guns were inoperable. I think the evidence, at least one, was clearly inoperable, and there was some ambiguity in the record as to whether the second one was operable. The guidelines are now advisory. There's nothing that requires the court to have given a three-level enhancement or upward adjustment simply because there's something that resembled a BB gun. The second and more important issue is the disparate nature of the sentencing between Woods, who got 220 months, and Knoll, who got 38 months. Now, this court has said on a number of occasions that 18 U.S. 3, 3553A6, which basically is the congressional mandate that there should not be disparate sentences between co-defendants, does not talk about individual cases. You've said this relatively recently. I'm asking this court to take a look at this again. This does not seem to be fair that the individual Christian Knoll who goes into the bank, who terrorizes the bank robbers, and as this court has read the trial transcript, the tellers were scared, and they should be. People are pointing what appears to be guns at them, demanding money, causing clear havoc in the bank. He's the one, Knoll is the one in the bank, and he's the one that's getting 38 months, and Woods gets 220 months. That doesn't seem fair. And even though this court has said that when we talk about disparate sentencing, we're talking about a nationwide look at it, I'm asking this court once again to consider, should there be some relative similarity in sentencing between co-defendants who do similar kinds of activities? And the final point I'd like to make in terms of the consecutive sentence. Now, the district court judge imposed a sentence of 60 months on count one, which was the conspiracy to commit bank robbery, and 160 months on count two, which was the bank robbery. I don't see how those two charges are different. They essentially are saying the same thing. I understand a conspiracy is different. You could be penalized. You could be sentenced on a conspiracy. But the elements are virtually identical here. These both talk about bank robberies. If you look at the counts one and two, they're really the identical counts. And to now be essentially punished on two separate counts for this and make them consecutive, if the judge had made them concurrent, I wouldn't be arguing to this court. But to make them consecutive seems unfair. And unless this court has questions, that's all the comments I wish to make.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Clifford Heisted, and I represent the United States in this case. The defendant's evidentiary challenges in this case simply lack merit because they should be reversed only where there's been an abuse of discretion. And there has been no abuse of discretion in this case. Turning to the first challenged evidentiary ruling, the evidence concerning Mrs. Sefcik. The evidence was very, very clear during the trial that her relationship with the defendant was based completely on the fact that she was a drug buyer and he was a drug seller. This notion that they were somehow friends is completely false. She testified at trial. She didn't even know the man's name. For the entire year that she dealt with him leading up to his arrest for this bank robbery, she only knew him by a street name, Man. She didn't even know what his actual name was until she was told by the police. These two were not friends. During the trial, she was asked, are you friends with the defendant? She said, no, I don't think you could say that we were friends. We were friendly. In other words, they were not hostile to each other. Questions were put to her by defense counsel. Well, did you trust him? I let him use my car. That's as far as I'll go. Well, did your children play together? Yeah, the children were with her when his children were with him. It's true that they live nearby, and that was convenient for her to go over there at all hours of the day and night, which is what she did, to get crack cocaine. They were not friends. The government could not say, because it was not true, that the reason she loaned him the car was because they were friends. The reason she loaned him the car was because she wanted to curry favor with him, her crack supplier. Now, keeping this in mind, the jury was entitled to know. It would have left a conceptual void in their understanding of the case. This story would not have been complete had they not been told why this woman would, on such short notice, for apparently no good reason, with no explanation, just lend this man her car. And what the government's evidence was in this case were responses to two questions. Two questions is all the jury heard from the government, where Mrs. Sefcik said, "I got drugs from him." Not crack cocaine. She did not say, "I got crack cocaine." She said, "I got drugs from him." Two times she made that statement. The jury did not hear from the government that the defendant was a drug dealer, that he sold crack cocaine. Plain and simple. That evidence came during cross-examination. It was appropriate that the jury hear this. This was not some hasty, off-the-cuff evidentiary ruling made by the district court. This was fully briefed. The district court issued a written order in this case. This order was issued 1 week before trial, and there was no abuse of discretion with respect to that evidence. Concerning Mr. Tierney, the credit union employee who identified the defendant, there is no error here. Nowhere in the briefs and nowhere in the argument you have just heard has there been a claim that there was error in allowing Mr. Tierney to testify simply because he at one time perceived the defendant as having close-cropped hair when the jury saw him as a bald man. That is nothing more than grounds for cross-examination, and that's exactly what happened here. The witness, without hesitation, looked directly at the defendant and said, "That is the man with whom I spoke at the credit union the day before the robbery." Plain and simple. Now, it's true that he fancied himself an artist and at one time had prepared a sketch that showed the defendant, and we respectfully submit that as the jury saw this sketch, and as you may have seen it in the record, that sketch shows the defendant. Okay, it was a very good likeness. Nonetheless, the government didn't seek to introduce that sketch. The defense introduced the sketch. And in the sketch, you see the defendant with close-cropped hair. Well, if the jury felt that this was still the defendant who had been identified, it was within their province to make that decision. And this is not something that should be second-guessed. They made their decision, and we should respect that. Not only that, but the defendant's girlfriend, Anita Robinson, his alibi witness, also testified. The defendant shaves his head. That's what she said during the trial. So even if it mattered, and it frankly does not, even if it mattered that the defendant had close-cropped hair when he was perceived by Mr. Tierney and that he was bald at trial, it doesn't matter. He could have possibly shaved his head, but in any event, it was certainly not an abuse of discretion for the district court to permit this first-hand eyewitness to testify at a bank robbery trial. It was perfectly appropriate for her to do that. Moving on then to the alibi, the so-called alibi in this case. What the government told the jury is the same thing we're going to say now. There just wasn't an alibi. The credit union was robbed at 9:20 a.m. The co-defendant, Kristen Noel, testified that they drove directly from the credit union to the defendant's home. The jury heard evidence that this trip takes about 10 minutes or 14 minutes if you're stopped by a train, because there was train tracks between the credit union and the defendant's home. The evidence that the jury heard was that the defendant could have been back at his house at 9:35 in the morning. The alibi witness, his girlfriend, testified that the best she could do by way of alibi was saying she was asleep, she woke up, the defendant was with her sometime between 9:30 and 9:45. So even if you believe the defendant's alibi witness, it doesn't mean that the defendant couldn't be at the bank. He was at the bank. The evidence proved that he was at the bank, and the jury heard that. This is if you choose to believe the defendant's alibi witness, and the jury would have been well within their rights not to believe the alibi witness. This was the defendant's girlfriend. She testified, "I love this man. I live with this man. I have children with this man. I don't want this man to be convicted." That was her testimony. The jury was entitled to disregard her. With respect to the fact that the defendant was at the Joliet Police Department later on and appeared on videotape, much has been made in the briefs about that. But it was made clear to the jury, and it's clear in the briefs, that there is no time stamp associated with the time that the defendant appeared at the police department. There is no dispute. Sometime later that morning, the defendant was at the Joliet Police Department, but it's not possible to say what time that was. We know that it was sometime between 10 and 10:50 a.m. This is of no consequence because the credit union was robbed at 9:20. There is no alibi here. There never was. With respect to Christian Noel, the credibility attacks on Mr. Noel, sure. Mr. Noel, on the night that he was arrested, said to the arresting officers, I did the robbery, and I did it with Anthony Jenkins, and I did the robbery with Donald Woods, the defendant in this case. That never changed. He identified those two people, and that never changed. The first night when he was arrested, he said that the defendant went in the bank and that he, Christian Noel, was the getaway driver. Before trial, even before indictment, he came clean, Christian Noel did, and all of these false statements that he had made, the one false statement about who was actually the driver, that was all put before the jury. The jury saw that he was impeached by a thorough and spirited cross-examination, and knowing that he had participated in the robbery, knowing that he had previously told a false statement to the police long before the trial, they still found him credible, and that's all that's required. Sufficiency of the evidence was clearly sufficient in this case, and as we know, this is a call for the jury to make. Unless it's impossible or legally impossible for the defendant to have committed the crime, sufficiency of the evidence, we can rely on the jury's verdict in this case. This court has held that even the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice is sufficient to sustain a conviction if the jury believes it, and if it's not, you know, manifestly against the law. Well, in this case, we had much more than simply Christian Noel's word for it. He was corroborated in many important respects, which are elaborated upon in the brief, but which I won't go into here. But I will say that he was corroborated in one important respect by Mrs. Sefcik herself, the woman who owned the getaway car. There's no dispute that her car was the getaway car, as you've pointed out, Your Honor. There was a vanity plate. The car was identified by both Christian Noel and by a credit union employee as being the car that was used in the bank robbery. Christian Noel said that the robbery took place, three people robbed the bank, two inside and one out in the driver's seat. That's corroborated by a credit union employee who saw that very same car, who saw a person in the driver's seat while two other robbers were inside. Also a very important corroboration for Mr. Noel is Mrs. Sefcik, who said, when I loaned my car to the defendant and not to someone else, 2 hours before the robbery, a child's car seat was in the back seat. The child's car seat was not in the back seat when the defendant and no one else returned the car to me 70 minutes after the robbery. Christian Noel, who never met Amy Sefcik, said that when the defendant showed up at his house that morning, there was a child's car seat in the back of the car. When he went inside to get the two BB guns and came back out, that child's car seat had been taken out of the back seat. This is important corroboration from two people who do not know each other. They did not conspire with one another, if that's the inference that one hopes to be drawn here, to somehow frame an otherwise innocent man. Quentin Reed, the defense offers Mr. Reed up as corroboration to the alibi. We can take this with a grain of salt. Quentin Reed is a convicted car thief who goes by the name of Swindle. All he said was that Christian Noel told him that he did the robbery with his two cousins. Well, we know that he did the robbery with two people he knew from around the neighborhood. Christian Noel testified that he often referred to them as cuzzo or cuddy, words that were derivative of cousin. Cumulative effect, there was no error in this case at all. In order for you to find that that there was an error in this case, there needed to be two errors, and that combined they needed to result in a fundamentally unfair trial. Well, there was no error, not a single error in this case, certainly nothing that arose to a fundamental flaw in the trial process. Moving on to sentencing, the defense asks you to disregard the plain language of the guidelines which characterize BB guns as a dangerous weapon. The guidelines simply state that an item that resembles a dangerous weapon, or even putting your hand in a towel to imply a weapon, constitutes a dangerous weapon. Just because Booker said that the guidelines are advisory we still know that they must be properly computed in the first instance. You must still first properly compute the guideline range, and then once you have the range, it's advisory. Booker did not say that we must disregard every guidance note that is found within the guideline range, and this court has held that a BB gun is a dangerous weapon. With regard to the sentencing disparity, this is easily dispensed with. Donald Woods is a career offender. He has no less than 50 criminal history points. 50. All it takes, as you know, is 13 to be a career offender. He has an astonishing 50 criminal history points. The man is a one-man crime spree. Christian Noel, two misdemeanor convictions. They're worlds apart. Christian Noel was a young man with two misdemeanor convictions who came clean, who admitted his guilt, who assisted the government. Donald Woods is an unrepentant career offender, multiple robber, drug dealer, who did not cooperate with the government and went to trial. Trying to compare his sentence to Christian Noel's sentence is, well, it's foolhardy, to be honest. With regard to the consecutive nature of the sentences, the fact that there was a sentence of 160 months on the bank robbery and 60 months on the conspiracy, that doesn't matter. In the end, it was a 220-month sentence. 220 months was at the low end of the guideline range. 220 months was substantially less than the maximum allowed just for the bank robbery conviction alone. The sentence was reasonable. It was within the guideline range. Whether the 220 would have been for the bank robbery alone or whether the 220 was consecutive, it doesn't matter. The sentence was 220 months. And if there are no further questions, the government will rest on its brief and ask you to affirm the defendant's convictions and sentence. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Rath?
The reason why the alibi is so believable in this instance is because we know that Woods and Robinson were at the Joliet police station at two separate points, and that's documented on tape. The fact is that Robinson testifies as to a time sequence that was necessary in order to get her car out of essentially the Joliet police pound. And the fact is that when they went to the police station the first time, and again, as government has pointed out correctly, all we know is that it's sometime between 10 and 10:49. That's all we know for a fact. But we do know she's there, and we do know she was turned away by the Joliet Police Department because she didn't have title to the car. We know they had to leave, and they had to go back to her house to get the title, and we know they came back because, again, she's on tape. The alibi is very substantive in this case, and that's why some of the errors that I am alleging are so important. Again, excuse me, Your Honor, I'm going to reply brief here. When in terms of the minimization of the questions that Sefik was asked, as I said on page 4 of the reply brief, on the government's case in chief, have you used drugs in the past? Yes. What drugs or drugs did you use? Crack. Were you addicted to crack? Yes. How long were you addicted to crack? From August of 05 till September of 06. How often were you using crack during that time period? At the beginning, it was about every weekend, and then it was about every day. So clearly, the crack comes out in front of the jury. It just wasn't necessary. These are the kinds of things that, again, the whole concept is, how do you give a defendant the fairest of all possible trials? It doesn't have to be a perfect trial. But when you have a very substantive defense, and then the government is allowed to bring in...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. And, Mr. Rath, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment.